heaven. Isn't that a long time? That's like a long service thing, isn't it? Wow. You have affected me slightly. I went home to my little Welsh Valley recently to see my dad, and he said to me, he said, "Son, you sound more and more like a little English boy every time I see you." And he didn't mean it as a compliment. So you are having a profound effect on me, or certainly on my accent. I suspect this lectern's going to fall apart as I try and use it, but we'll see what happens. I tell you what, let's not even bother. Let's have one of these music stands with all this wonderful music on. And would that be all right, musicians? Is that okay? Apparently, you're the most temperamental people in the church, but I've never believed that. That's just what others say. So it's a good job I didn't say it then, isn't it? That's what others say. Ah, that's better, isn't it? I have lots of books published in this whole world of children's ministry. Three curriculum books called called Fusion, Impact, and Detonate. My PhD is in child evangelism. Isn't that cool? Yeah, good. So I have a PhD in telling boys and girls about Jesus, and I'm rather proud of that fact. And nobody else has got one of them yet, but we'll see if some more can get there. That's published in a book called One Generation from Extinction. When I tell people it's a PhD in book form, nobody buys it. So now I just tell you simply, it contains the principles that will change the world. If you don't have a copy, you'll not be able to change the world. In fairness, if you've got a Bible, you might be able to get away with it. This is the newest one, Hanger on Every Word. It's 48 stories for telling. So it's not meant to be a book that you read from. You're supposed to read the stories and then tell the stories. You'll find in the introductory section how you do that, some principles on how you do that. And the Bishop of Oxford said, it's worth buying for the first part alone. Isn't that impressive? Yes, except none of you ever read the first part. You just jump straight into the stories. So I just want you to know that bit's there. I'm going to talk to you for a little bit. I want to talk to you about Jacob. His story kind of picks up around about Genesis 27. It kind of wanders into the low 30s of Genesis. It's quite an intriguing story. This young man, you know how the whole thing starts. He gets his brother's birthright, twins, by the way. He gets his brother's birthright because his brother's really hungry, and he sells his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of soup. That's how the whole thing starts. I suspect that might be okay. That's just greed on the part of Esau giving away his birthright for a bowl of soup. A little bit later, there's some deception that takes place. He dresses himself up to pretend that he's Esau in order to steal his brother's blessing. And his father blesses the wrong person. He has to escape. On the great escape, he comes to a place called Bethel. He sleeps and he sees the stairway to heaven, not the song, the actual stairway to heaven, and he has an encounter with God. This is his first point of conversion. And what you're going to discover in Jacob is that there are more than one point of conversion. This is his point where he meets God for the first time, face to face with God. And he is going now to walk down, and he's going to stay in Laban's house, and he's going to fall in love. Isn't that lovely? With a girl called Rachel. Isn't that lovely? And he says to Laban, I will work 7 years for you. It's not the most interactive crowd, is it? Maybe they don't understand me. I'll just keep talking anyway. I've discovered when I preach at the 8 a.m. service that nobody actually listens to the words. They just kind of like the lilting sound because it enables them to drift off quite nicely. So I hope that's not happening and you haven't had a wonderful lunch and you're all kind of disappearing. Anyway, Rachel, 7 years he works. At the end of those 7 years, he is supposed to do the whole marriage thing. But it's all going to go terribly wrong. Now, I am a bit worried about this point in the story. The Bible says he wakes up in the morning and realizes he has slept with the wrong woman. Certainly the people who knock on my vicarage door and give me that story, I'm not too convinced by. But he says that that's what happened. You gave me the wrong woman. That must have been some party the night before. And so he's married to the wrong sister. That's a bit of a dilemma. He then agrees with Laban that he'll work for another 7 years if, now what's the technicality in the deal this time? If I get the other sister now. All right, so within a week, he's married both sisters, but he's going to work for 14 years for it. Don't really know what happens towards the end of the story. He does a deal with Laban. Whenever some of the flock are speckled, you keep them. The ones who are not speckled, I keep them. And then he does something strange with some bark in front of the feeding troughs, and he causes the strong animals to come to him and the weak. I don't know how that works. But what I can see in it is more deception and more manipulation on the part of Jacob. So this man who has met God is not walking that well, although God is still abundantly blessing him. And when he is about to escape from Laban's house and go back to his homeland, he has accrued such a huge amount of wealth that from the start of the train to the end of the train of animals and people and sons and daughters and all the rest of it, there are hours and hours and hours of distance. So he has been abundantly blessed. Now he's going to make his way out. And as he's making his way out, this incredible thing happens. It's in chapter 32. It says this: Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is the camp of God." So he named that place Mahanaim. It's a really interesting word because it means the place of two camps. It means there is a choice about to be made very shortly. It is a place of two camps. It divides in that direction or that direction. And Jacob is about to come face to face with God himself. So Jacob's left alone, and a man wrestles with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. And then the man said, "Let me go, it's daybreak." Jacob replied, "Not letting you go until you bless me." And the man said, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he answered, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans, and you have overcome." And Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. There was a point in his life when he encountered God at a place called Bethel. And he encountered God, and he went through a conversion experience and started to be a follower of God, sort of. And God blessed him abundantly. And there came a point in the middle of his life where he met God again at a place called Peniel, and he wrestled with God. And from this point forward, it changes him. And listen, he walks differently. He walks differently. He has seen God face to face, and he has begun to walk differently. The interesting thing is, most Christians experience the God of Bethel. Very few Christians are prepared to go to the extra stage of encountering God at Peniel. This is the place of meeting God face to face. It involves a decision, a conscious decision. God, I will not let you go until you bless me. It is a conscious decision to hold on to God and say to God, "God, I want everything that you have for me, and I'm not letting you go until you bless me." Now, there's loads of stuff packed into that Jacob account. How I preach, it's the joy of the fact that I get to minister in lots and lots of different places, is my messages evolve. So when I first preached this, this is only the second time out, so it's still quite fresh. When I first preached this, it was kind of this long, And today it's going to be just a little bit longer. And I was saying to some of those of you who book into the Kids Leaders Summit in October up in Hawthorpe Hall, you'll hear this message again. It'll be this long. So we'll spend an evening on it because there's so much in it. So at the moment, we're just learning together. So I'm processing externally, as most kids workers do. And we're just picking up this stuff as we go. But what I want to do just now is I want to break from that and I want to talk directly about how you and I learn to walk differently. What does it look like for you and I to walk differently? What happens internally and externally that enables us not just to meet the God of Bethel, but to encounter the God of Peniel? What will it take? Right, number one, a recognition that you're it. A recognition that you're it. You are amazing. Amazing you. You are it. Psalm 139 says you were knit together in your mother's womb. God specifically put you together in the way that he put you together. You're it. A lovely Latin phrase, ex nihilo. It's to do with this all the stuff in Genesis 1, but ex nihilo means something out of nothing. So God spoke and there was light. So ex nihilo is the idea that God takes something and he makes it out of nothing. And there was a time when you didn't used to be. There was a time when there was no you. It must be difficult to actually understand. But there was a time when there was no you. And God took something out of nothing. And that's you. You're it. God stitched you together, wove you together. You're wonderfully designed. Before the foundations of the world were laid, God saw you. Just you. That's supposed to make us go, whoa. But because we're so jolly weighed down with the baggage of everyday life and 21st century culture, we've kind of thought, I'm just one of everybody else on the rat race. No, you're it. You are it. There is a moment for us all when we arrive and we take our first breath. And then there will be that moment when we take our last breath. But even before that, God started work on Project You. And you're looking pretty good in it. Before the foundations of the earth, he started work on Project You. How cool is that? Intricately woven together. So there is a moment when we take our first breath. And there'll be a moment when we take our last breath. And every single moment between that first breath and that last breath is a gift. You're breathing? Are you going to do it again in a second? And again, every breath is a gift, gift, gift. You breathe in, you received a gift, a generous, extraordinary, mysterious, and inexplicable gift. You are that gift. And every moment of your life is a gift. And you get to be responsible for what you do with that gift. How do we respond to that gift? All those moments are up to us. Things that happen to us, especially the painful, excruciating things that we never wanted and we have no control over, God enters into our suffering and pain as well. And he'll even make, this is hard to take, even make moments of suffering and pain into gift. That's what God does. He does it all the time. He intermingles everything, and he brings good. My completely overused quote is the one by Joshua Heschel, the 20th century philosopher. And he says this, and I love it. Above all else, remember that you're not a machine, you're a work of art. So you just say to yourself now, I'm not a machine, I'm a work of art. They try and squeeze me into machine mold and they try and make me behave like a machine. I'm not a machine. I'm a work of art. Whoever you are, whatever you do, no one has ever lived your life before. Nobody has ever lived your life with your challenges, your possibilities, your potential before. Unique. Project You is well and truly underway. So the first key to walking differently is to recognize that you are it. You've never been attempted before. We have no idea how this is going to work out. You're it. Number two, nobody cares who you aren't. Hear those words again. Nobody cares who you aren't. I am not a fireman. I am not a sailor. I am not an accountant. I am not. Who cares? We don't care who you are not. What you aren't is just simply not interesting. But I can take that further. I'm not smart. I'm not talented. I'm not beautiful. I'm not disciplined. I'm not educated. Nobody cares. What you are not is just not interesting. Nobody cares where you didn't go to school. Nobody cares what you haven't done. Nobody cares what you haven't accomplished. I'm not good at cooking. It's just too complicated. See? Nobody cares. Nobody cares what you're not good at. We're just not interested. So stop focusing on who you are not. You spend too much time on what you are not. Nobody cares. We are desperate to know who you are. Desperate to know who you are. Number three, who they are isn't important. We all have friends and colleagues and siblings who sail through life and they make it look like they are not making any effort at all while we slog away. It took me 4 goes to pass my driving test, whereas my sister, who is younger than me, had managed to pass on her first go before I'd managed to eventually pass on the fourth. She just made it look easy. Who they are just isn't interesting. We all know people who pass tests seemingly without studying. We all know people who earn lots of money but don't seem to actually do anything. That lovely moment when Jesus is reunited with Peter at the end of John's Gospel. And he's been asked, do you love me? Yes, you know I love you. Do you love me? Yes, you love me. Peter, before you answer this time, I need you to know something. There'll come a time when they will take you to a place where you don't want to go. And the Bible says by which they talked, Jesus talked to Peter about the way that he would die. And that's a little bit pressured. He's talking to him about the way he's going to die. So he does what we all do. He tries to distract Jesus from that particular idea. And he looks across to John and he says, but what about him? And Jesus says, what has he got to do with you? Whoa, that hurt. But that's the deal. See, what he isn't important. This is about you. Decide now that you'll spend your precious life, this gift, not speculating about someone else's life and how it compares to yours. This is Project You. What's happening to them, that's in the hands of a loving God. So we're focused on us. You never know. You never know. So you look at the superstars and you assume, but you never know. So when I heard that Bruce Springsteen suffers from extreme depression, a man who packs out huge, huge venues throughout the world, depression. When I read recently that Rob Bell went through burnout twice, completely flawed, completely incapacitated, emotionally out of it, you just never know. I hit a point in February this year where I broke completely. Never been there before. Never happened to me before. I couldn't do anything. I became an absolute emotional mess. I couldn't function. So I had to go through the process of slowly rebuilding me. Not there yet. A whole pile of support services are now built in around me. I built them in. I want you to hear that. I built them around myself. I went wandering out into the big, wide world to try and fix Project Me. No external support. The jolly Church of England is useless sometimes. And so I broke, and they didn't jump in. So I had to go and find my own counselor. And in fairness, I did make the bishop pay. But I had to find her. I had to book my own retreats. I had to drive myself to the Northumbria community and crash on their floor and say, help me. So I had to invest in Project Me, because it's important. The previous vicar in the place where I was, he had a difficult last decade of his time there. And I went to visit him down in Salisbury, and I said, well, what happened and what was the result? So he explained the incident which took place. And he said to me, for the last 10 years, I had no confidence and no joy. And I think that's tragic. And I'm not doing that. See, I do joy. I drip the stuff. That's what I do. Buckets of joy. But you have to begin to work that out. The counselor who I had to go with and find myself told me that I should be very proud of the fact that I had to go and find all my own support, because now I will own my own recovery. Yes, you need to understand that I pay her money for her to patronize me. And we rob ourselves of immeasurable joy when we compare what we do with what others do. Don't compare yourself with somebody else. It's about you. Not what about them. It's time to reprogram you. We're trying to create, right? This is the point. So we've been to Bethel. We met God. We're now going to Peniel, and we're actually going to do a bit of wrestling with God, and we are going to become the best us that we possibly can be. You understand that? Now, that doesn't happen. The Bethel experience happens with him asleep. Peniel actually involves effort. It involves grabbing hold of God and saying, hey, I'm not going anywhere until you bless me. And I know it's going to hurt. And he's going to walk differently for the rest of his life because of the injury that he gets at that point. But if you'd sat him down and said, Jacob, you're limping, he'd say to you, that angel did me a favor. Wrestle with God. We need to reprogram that. Chapter 181 of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Because all the chapters are prime numbers, aren't they? So chapter 181, he says this. Most people who find themselves in a field will see some cows in the distance and will know that there are trees. He said, but when I end up in that place, I know exactly how many cows there are, and I can tell you how many legs there are between them and how many tails between them, and I can tell you the structure of the trees and the number of trees. I can tell you how many items of litter there are in the heads. I can tell you the color of each of those items of litter. And he says, what happens is I'm overwhelmed with everything that I see around me until I have to put my hands over my ears and I have to hum to myself slowly, because it's my way of rebooting me. And some of us need to get to the point where we reboot ourselves, where we just start again. Hit Control-Alt-Delete on you and then rebuild from there. Next one then, you can do anything. Number four, you can do anything. You can create something amazing for God. Creation is not complete. Creation is not complete. Of course, the universe is expanding. Of course, evolution is true. The whole thing is developing and growing and changing because God didn't make anything static, particularly you. God didn't make anything static. It's all developing and growing. And you get to join with God at the creation and recreation of the world. Wonderful Hebrew words behind me. Tikkun olam. It means working with God at the repair of the universe. That's our task. So everybody sits down to a blank page. So life is a gift. Every breath is a gift. Who you aren't isn't interesting. Who you aren't isn't important. You have been given a blank sheet of paper, you can do anything. I'm trapped in a job I hate. No, listen, you can do anything. Yeah, but that would mean I would have to do this first. Right? That's fine. You can do anything. There is nothing which stands in your way. We need to reprogram our heads. There are three things which will try and block us. They are boredom, cynicism, despair. Boredom simply says this: there's nothing interesting to make. Cynicism, which pretends to be intelligent, says there's nothing new to make. Despair, which is my massive hate, says nothing we make is worth making anyway. But you can do anything. You can do anything. It's just that willingness to understand that you're working with God at the creation and recreation of the world. You should write that. Some of you have to fill in time sheets for your employer. Write it in Monday morning, 9 a.m. to 12, working with God at the creation and recreation of the world. Let's see if that provokes a discussion. So how are you going to respond to this? This life that God has given you as a gift, how are you going to respond to it? What are you going to do with it? What are you going to make of it? What's this got to do with a children's ministry training day? The simple answer is, if you can be the best you that you can possibly be, you will be like a jolly evangelistic combine harvester with the thousands of boys and girls, and we can get on with the actual task of re-evangelizing an entire nation, because it's really rather possible. Oh, I don't believe it. Well, that's the problem. You! And if I can just get across to you how important you are. Number five, listen to this. Ready? You could fail. Number five, you could fail. Turn to the person next to you and say the words, "Failure is completely overrated." That was only four words. You shouldn't still be. Okay. You failed. It's made you a better person. It's worked in your favor. It's made you stronger, more resilient, more appreciative. It's made you more approachable. It's made you more vulnerable. It's created all sorts of new life and growth and maturity. You see, failure is not all it's cracked up to be. This is the beautiful, counterintuitive, strange, unexpected, reliable mystery built into the fabric of creation. It says, every time we fail, it's all right. Because it means you tried, you leapt, you took a chance, you risked. This is not failure, this is being alive. And those people I bumped into who say, "Oh, I've never failed," I say, "You're probably dead." Dead people don't fail much. It's about trying new things, constantly exploring your destinies with you and God, nobody else, creating and recreating. Rob Bell says this: "The work I do has brought me more joy than I could ever measure. And there are times when it was so excruciating and disorientating and agonizing, I thought I was completely done." No one gets a free break from heartache. No one gets a free break from discouragement. Sometimes it is dull and wearying. Sometimes it is just a thud. But we didn't waste our time. We just got on with it. Failure is completely overrated. Don't chase success. Success says, "What more can I get?" Instead, I want you to learn to say this: "Can you believe I get to do this?" And just keep reprogramming your mind with that. Sunday morning, I've got a room full of kids, and there's me. Can you believe I get to do this? Now, my children's pastor has a nightmare with me, because every now and then I will force myself into a school assembly. And she'll say, but I've booked it. I said, come on, let me do one. And I'll stand in front of 500 kids and I'll say to myself, can you believe I get to do this? And you talk and they listen, and every word they just seeping in, and they hang on everything that you say. And can you believe it? Ah, they send me horrible letters, the PCC. They're constantly criticizing me. They don't appreciate. Who cares? Can you believe I get to do this? You see that reprogramming of mind? They don't appreciate me. Go book yourself into a school assembly. 500 little kids who think you're the greatest thing on the planet. Life affirming. Can you believe I get to do this? And we need to say that more often. Number 6, you have to be in it to win it. At any moment in the day, you can only do one thing at a time. And the more intentional about knowing what that is, the more present you will be. The more present you can be, the more effective you will be. I learned a little expression, again, stolen from Rob Bell's new book. And he said a friend of his has got one key phrase that he keeps playing in his mind. And he says these words, just this. I'm going to get it tattooed on your arm or something. Just this. So when you're sat having your evening meal and your mind suddenly dives to 3 days' time, pull it back and say to yourself, no, just this. When I'm in that conversation with that person in that place, no, just this. I'm actually going to be there. And the curse of the 21st century is we're rubbish at actually being present. And we have to learn how to do that all over again. The person who taught me to snowboard says this. He told me that my problem was my mind kept wandering. So he said, stop thinking about stuff that just isn't happening. And I said, okay, now I got it. My focus is on the board and on the snow and wiping out some skiers. Because that's actually why you snowboard, if I'm honest. But stop thinking about stuff that isn't happening. Is that you, middle of the day, doing whatever it is you do, but your mind's all over the place, playing out scenarios, wondering about certain things, constructing conversations in your mind, what you'll say, what they'll say in response, what you'll say. Is that you? Do you live there? Are you doing that right now? Drag yourself back. Just this. This is what I'm doing. I'm doing just this. Rob Bell again said, when you are constantly judging what you're doing, you aren't here. You aren't present. You're standing outside of your life, looking in, observing, which means you're not actually living. Just this. When was the last time you did something that gave yourself butterflies? Because this doesn't do that to me anymore. Remember the first sermon I preached when I was 16 years of age? I gave me immense butterflies. My tummy was flying everywhere. But this doesn't give me butterflies anymore. So when was the last time you did something that gives you butterflies? Go find something. Do something that captures that again. And if the butterflies go away, find something else that will put them back. And live here. You are here, but you're also there. No, don't do that. So if you're with that person, be with that person. If you're having that lunch, then have that lunch. I think I may start taking a hammer with me to lunch meetings. So when that person puts their mobile phone on the table in front of me, facing them, in case something more interesting appears on their screen, I think I might hit it with my hammer. I think that would make them very present. So if you're playing with the kids, play with the kids. If you're having a conversation, have the conversation. And you have to reprogram. All of us do, right? Because we're not good at it now. 21st century has messed up our brains. So every now and then we have to suggest this. I'm doing just this. And the power of being present. Just read what Jesus is like in the Gospels. He's always there. So incredibly powerful. So develop set times for dealing with emails. Building proper rhythms for your week. Run in the afternoon. Stop work at 4 p.m. Take that day off just for you. Take another day off to do research. So build those patterns into your life. The account of Moses and the burning bush, in the rabbinic accounts of it, they say it wasn't the case of the bush suddenly burst into flame. And actually, the biblical account is not that. They say the bush had been burning for some time. But Moses actually got slow enough and calm enough, and he was present enough to see it. I wonder how many burning bushes we've walked past. Drag ourselves back. Working with God at the creation and recreation of the world. I want to put up the next screen. I just want to just, there's two slides left and we're done. That's that wonderful Rob Bell challenge. There's a little introductory, but whatever it is that you find yourself in the midst of any given day, from laundry and meetings and traffic to going to class and answering emails and driving kids around, I want you to learn to live like you're not missing a thing, like your eyes are wide open, fully awake to the miraculous nature of our existence. And then he adds those words, and I'll let you read them. I want you to be here. I think I've let you get to the end of it. And then I'm going to take you to chapter 5 of Genesis, which is the last slide. And it says this. Then God said to Jacob, go up to Bethel and settle there, and build an altar there to God. So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, get rid of the foreign gods you have with you, purify yourselves, and change your clothes. So be different. Appear different. Walk different. In fact, if you drag out all those chapters from 27 to 35, the metaphor repeats again and again and again and again. The encounter, the transformation, the encounter, the transformation, the wrestling, the walking differently. And it's possible. And it just needs a few more people who will do Peniel. So we're just up in the level now. So we've got to the point, we've been doing this. We've been on this for decades. We have thousands and thousands of brilliant, brilliant, brilliant children's workers now who've been to Bethel. We now need some people who'll do Peniel, and not everybody will. But we need some people who'll wrestle with God, learn to walk differently, become everything that they possibly can be, and be fully present. Let's close our eyes. We're going to pray. So we have some musicians. We're slightly past our time. That means that our musicians will charge us double rate. Talk to Jesus yourself. Have a little chat. Is there something in there that connects with you and with God? And for some of you, we just need to pray for you. Some of those things have hit nerves, and we need to pray for that. Some of you have come to Peniel. Some of you have actually worked out the part that is excruciatingly painful, but you haven't yet realized that it's part of the process to make you you. And we want to pray for you in that as well. So as the people play behind us, and you talk to God where you are, if you want to be prayed for, and we need to be swift. So don't engage with God for too long on it. Then wander up to the front and we're just going to pray for you as well. So let's do that at this point as well. come quickly.